Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter, and as usual, I feel tremendously blessed and joyous and honored to be with all of you. I want to announce Deacon Errol Burke-Slivers and I are in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. So if any of you are in the Chagrin Falls broadcasting area and you're listening to this, or if you're in Ohio at all and you can make it within a drive, Deacon Harold Burke-Slivers and I will be preaching a mission at the Church of the Holy Angels in Chagrin Falls at 7 p.m. Eastern today. And we would love to see you here. The theme of the mission is This is the Hour, the urgency of answering the gospel message of Jesus Christ right now. There is no room for delay. And so we would greatly look forward to seeing all of you here. Now, to begin, we're going to start by talking about how parents can reclaim their authority in parenting. But in order to do that, we need to think about authority rightly. Dr. Greg Popchek will be joining us. And I love these segments because Greg offers some really practical parenting wisdom in a really applicable manner. Greg Popchek has identified three styles of parenting: permissive, authoritarian, and authoritative. Now, when it comes to discipline, many parents tend to ebb and flow and, frankly, swing to the extremes of either permissive or authoritarian. But the reality is we need to exercise our authority well and therefore be authoritative in parenting. But that means doing it in a loving manner, but also an effective manner, which means not enabling bad behavior and constantly disciplining in discipleship in a good way for the sake of bringing about the sainthood of our children. And so that's something that's really crucial for us to bear in mind. After that, we will speak with James Peregoy. The U.S. national debt, I've highlighted on this program multiple times now, is hovering around $30 trillion. It's hit about 100% of the U.S. GDP. And unfortunately, our GDP growth versus our growth of debt is disproportionate. We're growing in debt faster than our GDP is growing. So how did we end up here? And what happens now? Those are really crucial questions as we as Christians ought to think about, and therefore we ought to assess what the future is going to look like. And then finally, for the rest of the hour, we'll talk with my friend Daniel Lenman about St. John Vianney. His feast day is celebrated today. He's the patron saint of priests. For now, the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, August 4th. It's the feast of St. John Vianney. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. VisitingAngels.com. The wildfires in Spokane, Washington are at 0% containment. The fires have also forced nearly 65,000 people from their homes and have destroyed some 700 buildings. Spokane is the state's second largest city, and strong winds are pushing the fires so quickly that entire neighborhoods are charred to chimneys. Three more people accused of vandalizing the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool are having their charges dropped. This comes days after dismissing a similar case against Olympic canoeist David Hearn. Prosecutors now say the damage was caused by contractors during the pool's renovation, reversing earlier claims that the defendants were responsible. The decision has sparked criticism from President Trump, who insisted the damage was a result of vandalism and questioned why cases were being dropped. Wall Street now closing with stocks sharply higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 are both closing at a record high as optimism grows that the Strait of Hormuz will be reopened. The Dow and the S&P 500 are up over 1.5%, while the NASDAQ up over 2.5%. President Trump says ExxonMobil and Chevron are making too much money off a shortage. Speaking in the Oval Office, Trump said the country's two largest oil companies were taking in too much money and that they ought to give some of the windfall back to the public. The president says he's big free enterprise, but he's not happy about the situation. Several states have reported cyber attacks on water systems to the FBI. The states include Minnesota and Michigan. In a statement, the FBI says it's aware of the attacks and they are fully engaged to protect critical infrastructure. The FBI wouldn't provide any details on who's responsible for the attacks. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Joining me as he does every week is my friend Dr. Gregory Popchek, who talks about the family and the faith from the light of John Paul II's theology of the body and the biblical wisdom for marriage and the family. Dr. Gregory Popchek is also the founder and director of CatholicCounselist.com, and he and his bride, Lisa, co-host More to Life, produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN. Greg, great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm very well, Marcus. Great to be here. Thank you.
Always a joy and an honor to be able to connect with you. And today you're talking with us about the three most common parenting styles. So I'll give you the floor to present to us what the differences are between the three.
Sure. So there's permissive, which, just like it sounds, it kind of lets kids run naked and wild, right? the idea that, the positive idea behind that is, I don't want to squash my children's freedom. I want them to be able to make good choices or make their own choices, at least. The downside of it is exactly what I said. Any kind of structure or guidance, because the parent kind of checks out, whether intentionally or not. The second type of parenting style that's very common is the authoritarian parent style, and that's the more heavy-handed, do what I say because I said so, using punishments and yelling a lot of times as a way of kind of controlling the situation. Obviously that creates more structure than the permissive style, but it's not a lot of fun to either do, frankly. I mean, nobody likes to be an angry, over-the-top right. parent, and children don't thrive in that environment either. So then there's the authoritative style of parenting, which kind of combines the best of the two. It relies on structure, and it uses teaching instead of punishments so much to be able to shape and guide the child's behavior. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing this as we just let the kids run wild, and we don't see it as I have to control every moment of the child's behavior, but instead it's I'm looking at my child and seeing that they're trying to figure things out, and it's my job to help them figure things out. And if they're messing up, it's not because they're out to get me or they're being willful or mean. It's because they really don't know how to do the thing that they're trying to do.
Right.
And so it's on me as their parent, who has more resources and hopefully a little more maturity anyway, to be able to help them identify, okay, what are you trying to do? And then let me teach you a healthy way to do that. And then creating the structures that reinforce that. So it's authoritative in the sense that I'm not giving away my authority as a parent. I'm setting the stage for good behavior to thrive. Mm-hmm. I'm creating the structures that encourage that. I'm providing the guidance and the support to make those things happen. I'm not letting my kid get away with anything because I am in charge of the situation, but I'm also not fighting with them. You know what? I'll give you an example of a good sense of authoritative parenting. Actually, mm-hmm. we were just talking about this on More to Life the other day, where we were talking about using humor and silliness as a way of diffusing tension.
Uh-huh.
So, you say to your kid, hey, it's time to come to the table. No. And now, what most of us are going to do is like, now that we get into a fight with the kid, you need to get in here right now or I'm going to, But what if you used silliness and said, oh, you don't want to come to the table? What else don't you do? Do you not want to sprout wings and fly around the house? Or would you want to do this crazy thing instead? Or do you want a bunch of clowns to come in and dance with it? You're being silly, right? Mm-hmm. But you're being ridiculous. And the point of saying, this is not something I'm going to take seriously. And then you get the kids laughing about it and you say, okay, now it's time to come to the table. And they do. Because you didn't turn it into a power struggle. You made it into a little bit of silliness, and you didn't give away your authority. You treated the objection pretty much the way it deserved to be treated, as a joke, right?
Right.
And then you moved them right on to doing the thing that you wanted to do. In a sense, you're communicating that resistance is futile, but you're doing it in a way that doesn't start World War III in your household.
And there's a real brilliance there in terms of the exercise of charity on the part of parents, because you've got that dynamic of responsiveness and warmth in an interplay with demanding control or expectations.
Well, exactly. And it's that warmth that allows us really to reclaim our kids' hearts and take down the temperature in the household without giving away our authority. So that authoritative approach to parenting allows us to set rules and structures in a way that creates peace in the household, but doesn't make me kind of the dictator of the home. And in fact, we were actually talking about this in a discussion we were having on Catholic Home, our Catholic Households on Mission app, where we were talking about, you know, how to reclaim our strength and authority as parents without falling into that authoritarian approach to parenting. And one of the things, you know, one of the questions we get a lot from parents is, well, how do I know if my rules are too much or too little? Mm. You know, and so I think the authoritarian answer to that is, you know, well, what if I'm inconvenienced, then I need to set down a rule and a consequence about that. With the permissive parent, it's, well, I just want to let everything happen because I don't have the energy to get involved. Mm. But with the authoritative parent, the boundary is, what do we need to do? How do we need to treat each other that makes this home safe and loving? You know, I don't have to kind of question, are these rules okay? Well, are the rules that I'm imposing allowing us to be a safer and more loving household? Mm. Are they allowing us to enjoy each other's company more? Then good, that's a standard to have. Let's put it in place and talk about how we can all work together to enforce it and keep it up. And again, that's the authoritative idea of I'm looking at the big picture and saying, what structures do I need to create to build a loving and safe an enjoyable household where we all work together?
The problem with the first two models, you know, permissive versus authoritarian, is they lean too far to one side because they fear the other, like you've mentioned. So the permissive parent wants the child to have the highest self-esteem possible. The authoritarian parent wants the child to have the highest discipline possible. Would you please comment on that in light of the call for us to be virtuous authoritative parents?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it comes down to, you know, the permissive parent is not teaching virtue. They're kind of assuming that the noble savage, that sort of Rousseauian idea of their inner good is just going to come out, and if I just give them space, that they're going to learn how to just be wonderful, and that's just not true. The authoritarian parent kind of assumes that all human beings are naturally corrupt, and unless I kind of, you know, beat the devil out of them, they're not going to be holy and good people. Mm-hmm. The authoritative parent, actually, I think it has a sort of unconscious Catholic vision of the person where, you know, we're all basically good, but we are wounded by sin, and so we need guidance, and we need structure, and we need the support to cultivate virtue in us. And so it assumes that underneath all the bad behavior and irritating things that we all do, there is a good intention or need attempting to be expressed, but it's my job as the parent to help my kid express that in a healthy way. And so, you know, this is a case we've made in our parenting books going all the way back to the beginning when our book first came out in 2001, that you know, what we're really trying to do here is not just discipline kids by, you know, coming up with things to do to them to make them do what I want them to do, but in all of our interactions convey a Catholic worldview, a Catholic mindset. And so this authoritative style of parenting mm-hmm. really conveys that idea that, you know, you are good, and the things you want are good, and the things you want to do are good, but we often want to do those good things in kind of ungood ways. And so as your parent, I want to help you learn the virtues that enable you to pursue all the good things you want in the best ways possible.
You and I both know that in the 60s, the psychologists like Diana Bomren were the ones who came up with some of these categories, but like you mentioned, they're accidentally Catholic. Meanwhile, you and Lisa present an actually Catholic approach to this. So what resources do you have for parents who'd like to explore how to better become authoritative parents?
Well, thank you for that. And so, of course, our parenting books, Parenting Your Kid with Grace, which is birth to age 10, and then Parenting Your Teens and Tweens with Grace, is 11 to 18. Mm-hmm. So those two books really lay out a lot of what we're talking about here. But we also offer the Catholic Home app, and that's mm-hmm. spelled H-O-M. It stands for Households on Mission. And through that app, we provide daily parent coaching. So Lisa and I and our whole team of pastoral counselors and coaches are on there interacting with subscribers every day, answering subscribers' questions, hosting moderated discussions. We have a monthly live Q&A. But in addition to that, there's a ton of creative resources, podcasts, activities, videos, a cartoon series on how to build a domestic church that you can watch with your kids. It's really a lot of fun. So just a lot of great resources to help make living the faith at home simple and fun, make parenting more enjoyable, and really get the support you need as a Catholic family these days.
Greg, always a joy and an honor. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Marcus. God bless.
My guest has been Dr. Gregory Popchick, founder and director of CatholicCounselors.com. He and his bride, Lisa, host More to Life every day on EWTN Global Catholic Radio. And we've been talking about the three styles of parenting and how we as Catholics should be virtuous and authoritative. I'm Marcus Peter.
Brought to you by the nonprofit Seton Home Study. Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. You want to pass the Catholic faith on to your children? A very good way is to teach your children at home. You want to protect your kids from the toxic culture that surrounds us? Do you want to have a greater influence in what your kids are learning? Once more, a great way is to teach your children at home. No teacher is going to care about your kids as much as you do. Seton Home Study School is the best way to teach your children at home. Go to setonhome.org. setonhome.org.
This program is brought to you in part by Dave Tyson with Real Estate for Life, a faith-based organization, and Texana Bank, offering residential mortgage assistance across all 50 states, including purchases and refinances with conventional FHA and VA loans. More information can be found at re4l.org. Again, that's re4l.org.
All loans subject to credit approval. Texana Bank, NMLS 407536. Equal housing lender. Member FDIC.
This Ave Maria program brought to you in part by the following nonprofit.
One of the greatest threats to your family isn't a disaster or a virus, but addiction. In nearly every family and every pew, someone is silently struggling. Beginning July 11th, Shalom World TV and the iThirst Initiative present Unshackled, a powerful new series on the Catholic Church's response to the addiction crisis, bringing together leading voices to discuss real healing. Stream it free at shalomworld.org or on the Shalom World app today.
Ever get asked one of those tough questions, like, do Catholics worship Mary? And in that moment, you freeze? Truthfully, the Catholic AI app gives you answers in seconds rooted in scripture, tradition, and the magisterium. Whether you're navigating a tough conversation, deepening your faith, or looking for daily spiritual guidance, Truthfully helps you know, live, and defend the Catholic faith. Truthfully can be found in the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Truthfully, Truthly.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mark Spita. The U.S. national debt, it's hovering around $30 trillion. It's hit 100% of the U.S. GDP. So how did we end up here and what happens now? Joining me to have a conversation about this is James Paragoy, no stranger to this program. James is co-manager of the Ave Maria Bond Fund and the Ave Maria Undiscovered Fund. He's also a research analyst responsible for fixed income research and trading functions. And he's responsible for equity trading functions of the mutual funds. And he is with Ave Maria Mutual Funds, as I mentioned. James, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Hey, Marcus. I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm very well, thank you. And it's always great to reconnect with you. So we've got this great question of the U.S. national debt. And many people don't quite know how best to navigate this. What's a good starting point for this conversation?
Yeah, I think it is a serious problem, but it's likely not one that would produce a catastrophe overnight. As you mentioned, we hit 100% of GDP or of publicly held national debt equal to GDP, which is a milestone of sorts, not a good one. That topic came up in the news a few months ago, but has since faded from the headlines. So I think it warrants further discussion. It's important to keep in mind that GDP is it represents our total economic activity. So when debt reaches parity with that, it may be harder and harder to dig ourselves out of that hole. So I'm glad we can revisit this topic.
The debt surpassing the GDP, there are a few things that are going to happen as a result of it. So as of late July last year, what do we know about this?
Yeah, so it hit $32 trillion. That's our publicly held debt. And I think there's also a moral discussion to be had about this. How did we end up here? The moral dilemma being that our spending today may be putting undue burden on future generations by leaving them with a cumbersome national debt load. Additionally, we may be leaning on this as a crutch to avoid trade-offs. So we have various entitlement programs and defense, and we promise a lot of things that we don't fully have the resources to pay those immediately. And then the final thing I would say is the U.S. has held the reserve currency status for a while now, since World War II, about. And so this has given us, blessed us with a lower borrowing cost than typical and the ability to regularly overspend So we should aim to be responsible and not abuse that power.
One of the great concerns that everyone listening has about this issue is we're just taking on more and more debt, and therefore sloughing that debt onto our children, unborn or otherwise. And that's a bill that's going to be passed on for who knows how many generations. And these are people who can't even vote yet, and they're being born into this debt. So share with us about the moral dimension of this.
Yeah, I think a lot of this, you know, it comes out of some kind of complacency. You know, we borrow in times of crisis. So I guess the last big one would have been COVID. You know, businesses were shut down. And so some amount of stimulus was necessary. And we tend to overdo that. And then once we come out of that situation, the recovery starts to be underway. We tend to not give up those benefits so readily. And then additionally, I'd say the political culture and the rise of populism has also contributed to this issue, as more and more candidates promise benefits to voters in a way to win votes. And it's hard to be the one candidate that, you know, doesn't make those promises. He's less likely to get elected that way.
Have we been responsible about it, though? You know, we're making promises about benefits and tax relief and services and entitlement programs, but do we have the resources to match those promises?
No, and I think our annual deficit kind of speaks to this. So in 2025, the U.S. government brought in about $5.2 trillion in revenue, but it spent $7 trillion, so it came up short by about $1.8 trillion, and that's about 6% of our GDP. And that's not that's high. It's a way over the baseline of what you would expect in a non-recessionary period. It is down as an annual, you know, deficit as a percentage of GDP from COVID, where it was 15%. But still, you would expect it to be closer to a baseline, closer to 0%.
Is that normal?
No. So, yeah, 6%, like I said, after, well, if we revisit the late 90s and early 2000s, we actually ran four consecutive years of budget surpluses. And that was aided by kind of the we had some productivity growth from the internet. And then we, you know, had the restraint and fiscal discipline to keep spending flat. And since that period, you know, that has kind of become the new normal, but it shouldn't be.
And that's upsetting. And undoubtedly, everyone listening, they have a further question, which is very simply, how fast is that debt accumulating?
Yeah, so we're at just under $32 trillion in publicly held debt currently. We hit the first $10 trillion at about 2011. The next $10 trillion in cumulative debt took 9 years to reach in 2020. And the next $10 trillion, so $30 trillion, took another 6 years to reach in 2026. So it's accelerating. It is cause for concern, but like I said earlier, not for panic.
How much of our present political culture now is developing to that? You know, we have such a populistic system of politics now that's not thinking of long-term policy and the general good of the American people.
Yeah, certainly. Like I said before, it's hard for, you know, with a government and large bureaucratic organizations, it's hard for any one area to kind of give up the budget that they had. And so that can contribute to it, like I said, the populism, candidates overpromising. And then also, I guess, when you look at just the annual budget of what the government spends money on, about 60% of government outlays are for mandatory programs. So that would be tied to entitlement programs and benefits. These are things that are hard to touch, hard to reduce. You would have a good amount of kind of fervor attached to that. Then 27% is discretionary spending. So this is stuff Congress can amend. Defense happens to be a major component. And so, you know, in a kind of geopolitically fraught time we live in right now, that's also kind of one that might be hard to touch. And then what is concerning is that interest now represents about 13% of the total outlays. And that, you know, if we don't get things under control, that could continue rising, and it could crowd out other areas of spend that might be necessary.
So you've talked briefly about where the federal government is spending that money. The question really now is, how do we get out of this problem?
Yeah, and there's no easy way to do it. We have done it in the past, and then also, you know, there is no absolute indebtedness level where we can predict that, you know, we would start having immediate consequences. You can look at Japan, for example, which is 200% plus of debt to GDP. But there's a few levers you can pull when we think about that debt to GDP ratio. If you look at the denominator, GDP, pro-growth reform, and that kind of thing to grow the economy would make the debt smaller in proportion to that. And then if you look at the numerator, getting back to working towards budget surpluses would help a lot.
I've been talking with James Paragoy. He is he's a manager of funds with Ave Maria Mutual Funds. And we're talking, I want to highlight here, find out how Ave Maria Mutual Funds are doing and what they're doing at AveMariaMutualFunds.com. And consider their bond fund, the Ave FX, and the Ave Maria Undiscovered Fund, Ave UX. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series, will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking, and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
And we need to pray for all our world leaders and all those who are in such danger. See, in a day and age where people are getting further away from God, you get further away from goodness. Only God is good. You remember what our Lord said one day? Why do you call me good? He said, only God is good. Only God.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Why is sacrifice an important part of worship? The Catholic Catechism tells us that it is right and good to offer sacrifice to God as a sign of adoration, gratitude, supplication, and communion. What is the sacrifice most pleasing to God? Psalm 51 says, "It is a broken spirit." What does that mean? Paragraph 2100 of the Catechism counsels, outward sacrifice, to be genuine, must be an expression of inward spiritual sacrifice. Old covenant prophets denounced sacrifices that were not from the heart or not coupled with love of neighbor. The one perfect sacrifice was Jesus' agony and death on the cross. By uniting ourselves with the Lord's sacrifice, we can make our lives a sacrifice to God. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. St. John Vianney, his feast we celebrate today. And he once said that the priesthood is the love of the heart of Jesus. And when you see a priest, think of our Lord Jesus Christ. We talk about the meaning of the priesthood with Daniel Lenman. Daniel is Dean of Students and Assistant Professor of Theology at Ave Maria University. Daniel, great to speak with you. How are you?
It's good to speak with you too, Marcus. I'm doing very well. We just welcomed our early arrivals yesterday, and we're looking forward to new students coming on for orientation on the 17th of this month. So it's an exciting time at the university.
I was going to say the exact same words. It's always an exciting time in the life of the university, all those fresh young faces, especially the incoming freshmen and transfers. They're going to encounter Ave Maria University for the first time. I think before we talk about the topic proper, I invite you to share about Ave Maria University and its mission and how students are benefiting by going there.
Oh, sure. Thank you so much. Yeah, the mission of Ave Maria University is very straightforward. We are interested in forming future saints as a fountainhead of renewal for the church and the world. That's our goal, and that's always been the goal. We do that principally through providing a Catholic liberal arts education. We've got 30 or so majors now across disciplines, from theology to engineering, all with a view to really raise up leaders for society. And that's the idea, and we believe having that foundation in a liberal arts education will serve them well in whatever area or discipline that they study or career that they tackle, that they'll be equipped to really be servants of Christ and please God, saints in this life and in the next.
So from there, as we talk about saints, one saint that we want to focus on today is St. John Vianney. And he was a man who, for whom education didn't come easy. So he would have benefited, I believe, from an Ave Maria University formation. But let's talk about his life for a little bit.
Yeah, well, he was, born in poor circumstances. I know that he wanted to go to school as a young man, but his father was reluctant, the cost. Mm-hmm. I think he had done something like 1 year of school when he was nine, and he didn't do very well. I think he also ended up, he got recruited into the army at some point and was a deserter for a while, but I think eventually he got back to school, but was never a great student. Important to recognize that that's not to say that he wasn't, that he was stupid or dull or something. Like he was especially clear-headed about matters of moral theology. Mm-hmm. He always was able to see keenly into those things, and that's one of the things that served him especially well in the confessional.
And this was a man whose heart was given for the salvation of souls, and his sound concept of sound grasp of moral theology drove him to hours upon hours in the confessional. Share with us the heart of this man. Help us get into an appreciation of that.
Yeah, there's so much. So, I mean, it's so apt that he is the patron saint of parish priests. And he's really just set this exemplary model for us, recognizing the church is really the field hospital for souls, a hospital for the souls, for souls. That's an idea that goes back to the fathers. You know, John Chrysostom would talk about that, and he really took it to heart in the way he lived out his life. So he would be in the confessional for 16 hours a day, and this is even in the summer that he would do that. Always being ready to minister to the poor, and this became well known, and so people were struck by the guidance and insight that he had, and the great love with which he had for souls. He was known to say something to the effect that he would give, light penances, and would kind of make up the difference, as it were, in his own life. So he lived a very ascetic life, often keeping late vigils and fasting, all for the sake of souls.
When he was canonized, he was, in that same month, we had doctors of the church, like Therese of Lisieux and Peter Canisius, who were also canonized. And yet he is no less a saint than these great teachers. I know the temptation is to look at the Aquinas and the Augustines of the world, but we have to remember that men like these, women like these, also make up the great magnificence of the communion of saints.
Absolutely, you bring up an important point. There's not necessarily, the formal teaching, but there's always that example, and the particular humble example. I often speak with my students about the lives of saints, and that one of the reasons that it's helpful to to study their lives is to see the great variety of ways in which sanctity can be realized. There's no one way to be a saint. And so you don't need to be a great intellect or a teacher to be a great saint or even a great priest. What is needed is that devotion to the people around you. So St. John Vianney recognized deeply the great sanctity of his office, and he saw it as an office of service. So he if he's going to be a priest, I'm here for souls, and that's and all parish priests can be inspired by that as an example for how to minister to souls. And this is really crucial. It's no surprise that his devotion to time in the confessional attracted many people, sometimes tens of thousands of people that would arrive to this little village to be near a saint, as they called him, even while he was alive.
Can you also share with us how that drive of his heart, whether we are ministerial priests or not, should be part of how we live out our baptismal call, that you and I, in our own spheres, are here for souls as well?
I think that's a profound point of reflection, in fact. I think perhaps there's a kind of clericalism that's always on the verge of creeping in here, where we say, oh yeah, that kind of great service and devotion, that sort of radical commitment, that's for priests and religious. But you're exactly right. It should be a model for us all in that way, and whatever way of life that we're called to or living out, that we have it. We have to live it in a radically, in radical service to God, and to God and our neighbor through charity. I think that's exactly right. So perhaps it's not 16 hours in the confessional, but it might be, 16 hours of work for a great cause, if you need to, or staying up 12 hours through the night taking care of sick children, or those sorts of things, all doing it with great love. I think that's exactly right. That's he's a real inspiration for all of us in that way.
We're running out of time in this segment, but given what you've just shared, Daniel, I also want to invite you. You and I had conversations about this in the past. We've lost our capacity for just a life of sustained, peaceful contemplation. I mean, John Vianney sat in that same confessional for 16 hours. This was a man whose heart wasn't restless.
That's right. That's right. And I think that that's... Oh, yeah, that's worth a much longer conversation than we have opportunity for. But, yes, he was able to do that, I think, because he was at peace with himself, and he was able to be at peace with himself because he was content in the service of God that he was carrying out at that time. And that's so important.
I'm talking with Dr. Daniel Lenman. He and I are old friends, and he is now the Dean of Students and Assistant Professor of Theology at Ave Maria University, our mutual alma mater. And we're talking about St. John Vianney and, frankly, the wondrous lessons that we can learn from his life and to talk about the priesthood with him on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
I must tell you that from what I observe from very young people, all of these blasphemers, all of these mockers are in for a tough time. Because the devil bites his own tail. And I find among young people a growing reverence and longing for God. I find a decline in the cynicism and skepticism around, because it had to destroy itself. No one can live on being an enemy of God. It's too crazy. It's too absurd. It's too dark. It's too bleak. God is beautiful. God is holy. Why in the world mock God?
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Life is hard and we have to struggle against so much, including the ongoing struggle against our own sinfulness. And sometimes we just want to say, no more, I'm done. But God isn't done with you. I'm Dr. Marcus Peter, and in my book, Not Finished Yet, I can show you how God has already begun a wondrous work in you, in each of us, and only needs your cooperation. Find Not Finished Yet and all of our other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Dr. Daniel Lindman, Dean of Students and Assistant Professor of Theology at Ave Maria University. So, Daniel, we got cut off at the break, and I understand you're completely right. We'd be here forever just contemplating the interior peace and disposition of the kind of man who could sit in a confessional for 16 hours. But I would like to ask if you could shed a little more light into becoming such a man ourselves. Or women.
Yeah, well, I wish I was better at it myself so I could get, but it's something, you know, I'm still very much imperfect and striving for. There's a lot that goes into this kind of interior peace that's so necessary. Being still and having that interior peace often means then confronting sort of the problems that we're typically trying to distract ourselves from, which is a lot of the reason we don't want to be still and recollected. We're typically trying to avoid those things. I've often talked to my students, especially about, you know, like being on their phones incessantly, and I tell them, it's like, you know, if you put it away for a while, it's going to be kind of scary because you might find out that you're kind of sad.
Yeah.
And I say, and you probably should be sad, and the reason you should be sad is because there's probably something wrong in you, in your life, that you need to think about and pray about and work through, and to not be afraid of that. And as a soul can become more aware of its need for assistance, then the soul can become more and more open to God's grace working within that soul. And that's really what's, I think, you know, the Curiosidades had such great insight into, was that, you know, both in the souls of others and in his own soul, the great way that God's grace can work within us to bring about that healing and to bring us to sanctification.
I was reading the Office of Readings today, and what you said just reminded me of one of the paragraphs in the second reading, which was from John Vianney's Catechism on Prayer. And he says something to the effect of, when the heart is pure and united with God, it's consoled and it's filled with sweetness. And then he goes on, it's very majestic, very poetic, but that's the remedy for that sadness that you just described.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's, you know, it's not the fleeting kind of happiness or, you know, pleasantness that might come with, you know, having whatever, a nice piece of chocolate cake, as good as that might be. But, you know, this is the peace and the joy that surpasses understanding and that can be with us even through the midst of great suffering. And that's something that is part of Christ's promise, which when we lack that ability to recollect, we actually exclude ourselves from having and experiencing that deep joy and peace that really can belong to us, even in the midst of great trials, which always come.
Now, to that end, I want to step back a little and also ask you about something profound you said in the last segment, that while the Curiosidades was a ministerial priest, an ordained priest, he paved a saintly way for all of us, that there's an inheritance to our baptismal call that we can borrow from him. Would you please share with us what it means to live out, in this sense, our common priesthood and what we can learn from John Vianney?
Yeah, I think that's, again, a great topic for reflection. So if we recall, the role of the priest in general is one who intercedes with God on behalf of the people. And all Christians, in virtue of our baptism, the character that with which we are marked on our soul, is a power which enables us to truly and properly worship God, sort of from the depths of our being. And so this is a great gift and a great obligation to us, as all of us, to really pray and intercede with God on behalf of all people, again, just in virtue of your baptism. So this is where we are truly a priestly people, all of us, in this role to help sanctify the world. So this is, done principally through prayer, but also, of course, through the witness of our lives and through holy conversation, leading others to Christ through our example and through our speech.
Again, you know, that second reading from the Office of Readings, again, the last paragraph, I think, he says something to the effect of, I often, some people appear as if they go to prayer just to say to God, I'm just going to say a couple of words so I can get away quickly. No, go ahead, please.
Well, just that reminds me about the way some of my children approach prayer on occasion.
Okay, let's be honest. That's also me, and so many of the adults we know, right? I just got to get this in, and then I'm in, I'm done, I'm out.
Yeah, yeah. As opposed to, we're really called to rest in God in prayer, right? And this is. And sometimes, especially if we have pressing concerns and things like that, that it's like, oh, I've got to get up and do this, I've got to do this. It is important for us to pause and reflect, especially, it's like, no, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is my joy. And sometimes we have to kind of, I feel like we have to convince ourselves a little bit, because we don't always feel it, but we have to recognize it. And again, this is why St. John Vianney's asceticism is not accidental to his life, right? We have to be disciplined in our lives in order to have that clear spiritual insight about the presence of God, and doing the work of God in prayer is our joy. It's hard for us to recognize that if we're always thinking about the next pleasant thing or, you know, pleasurable thing that we want to be doing, or even the next work or pressing thing that is around the corner.
Okay, you highlight a tremendously powerful point that I'd like to invite you to speak deeper into. John Vianney, as he sat in those confessionals, as he spent hours in adoration, as he rehearsed his homilies out loud multiple times before delivering them, it's not like all of those things were pleasurable to him or deeply, constantly pleasurable to him. This was a man who embraced the difficulty of doing these things that were good for the soul. And so he had he had that fruition within him, that joy that springs forth from within. I invite you to compel us that way.
Oh, that's a rich reflection. Thank you for bringing that up. This is, I guess I'll go about it this way. The kind of easiest sins for us to fall into are the sins against temperance. You know, they're frequent, and maybe not all of them are very grave, but they're the most kind of persistent for us. And so this is why, you know, it's so beautiful that the Church gives us dedicated seasons for fasting and things like that, so we can enhance our discipline and practice, especially in those times, so that we can form that habit, really, of infused temperance, and grow in our understanding and docility to the work of the Holy Spirit in us, to see where we need to be more penitential and more ascetic, in order to serve God in our mission, wherever it is. So, you know, we all have different states of life. And so maybe your state of life, you know, it's like, well, I can't do this fasting or something because I need to, you know, I have a heavy lifting job and, you know, that I'd faint on the job. Okay, those that you need that prudence to guide your work. But whatever that asceticism might look like, it might look like embracing this work, whatever that work might be, with even when it's difficult, again, for the love of God and for the love of neighbor.
And that really is the Christian life, understanding that we're not made for a constant series of pleasure to pleasure to pleasure. And in that light, if John Vianney was alive today, Daniel, and he took a look at just how we as a society have deliberately crafted technology and life to distract and pleasure us in short, constant bursts, what would he say to us?
Oh, my. Yes, I think he would see that all of that is sort of inevitably weighing the souls down. You know, the one of the great probably sins of our age is this, is just that this kind of apathy in souls, this inability for souls to really get up and realize that there's some work to be, acedia is what we call it, really, to recognize that we need to embrace the challenges of life. And this is, you know, some the critics of the faithful will say that we're sort of sadistic or something of this. This is not what we mean. This is not because we like suffering for suffering's sake. It's just recognizing that suffering is a part of this life, and you can either try to avoid it, and then you'll run into more and different kinds of worse sufferings, or you can learn to suffer well. And the only way to suffer well is to suffer with charity in Christ Jesus.
Daniel, as usual, always a joy. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Daniel Lenman, Dean of Students and Assistant Professor of Theology at Ave Maria University. We've been talking about lessons we can learn from St. John Vianney as we celebrate his feast day. Let's learn to emulate the heart of the man who was given entirely for Christ. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.